In this episode of Startups the Rest of Us, we're going to be talking about sex and software. This is Startups the Rest of Us, episode 322. Welcome to Startups the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike. Today, we're going to be sharing our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So today's episode is going to be a little bit different. Today, we're going to be talking about sex and software. And today's episode starts with a listener question. And this listener question comes from Samori. And he says, hi, I was wondering if you could do a show on what we can all do to reduce the amount of straight-up misogyny female coders and founders face. Last week, I followed a tweet from Justin Jackson, and we'll link that tweet up in the show notes. And he says that led me to a presentation by Jen Schiffer at the XOXO Festival. I also watched the Talia Jane presentation at the same festival. The amount of vitriol these women suffer is incredible, and I just don't understand why it has to be that way. Where does all this anger from men in tech come from? What have you guys seen in your experience? My experience is as a consultant, and there's an incredible amount of sexism in IT consulting, but I don't think I've seen all this anger, or at least this level of anger, played out in front of me as a past manager. I love the show, of course, and it would be nice to hear what your own goals are in terms of women and female coders in the new year. Also, since I am black, what has been your personal experience and goal making around diversity in general? Thanks, and I'll see you at MicroConf. So I think that there's two different pieces to Samori's email. The first one is that there's two different questions in there. The first one was, where does all the anger for men in tech come from? And the second one is, what are your goals in terms of female coders and founders of the new year? Also, since I am black, what has been your personal experience and goal making around diversity in general? So I do want to touch on that just a little bit from perspective of running MicroConf. And for a little bit of perspective, we don't ask this question outright to our attendees. We don't ask them, you know, what's your racial makeup? What is your gender? It's just not something that one, we feel comfortable asking, but two, is really just not relevant to people coming to the conference. I talked to Xander a little bit about what we've kind of believed that the makeup of female to male attendees is. It seems to be that it's about 15%, but obviously that is based off of names. So it's a little bit difficult to get exact numbers. In terms of what we do at MicroConf, one of the things that we do is we do some active outreach to female entrepreneurs to make sure that they're able to attend if they want to. I'll say that we do take some liberties with the waiting list to make sure that people are able to get tickets if they need them or if they want them, to kind of help with that diversity, to make sure that females have a chance to get to MicroConf, because in the past, MicroConf has traditionally sold out extremely quickly. So to help out with that, just because if you're not sitting there at the button, it can be difficult to get a ticket. So that's one of the things that we do. Another thing that we've done is we implemented a code of conduct at the request of an attendee a few years ago. So if you go out to the MicroConf website, there is a code of conduct. It's based on a publicly available standard for codes of conduct that are out there. Another thing that we do is we actively recruit female speakers. What we found is that there's a tendency for female founders to not apply to speak at MicroConf because we do have an application process, but it seems like we do not get as many who come forward and say, hey, I would like to speak. So we actually go out and actively approach them and ask them. Another thing we've done is we have actively set aside pools of tickets for female entrepreneurial groups. So we've gone out, we've approached those groups and said, hey, here's a pool of tickets that is kind of separate, and it helps to bypass, you know, I'll say the tickets going off the shelves very, very quickly, so that there are opportunities for female founders in those groups to purchase MicroConf tickets if they would like to attend. And then the last thing is we also have MicroConf scholarships. So the past 2 years, we've had a couple of scholarships that have been given out. One went to Francesca and another one went to Shannon. Both of those scholarships were actually given by MicroConf attendees. So the MicroConf attendees said, hey, I'd like to do a scholarship. And it's not something that we made a big deal about. And it's not something that we talked heavily about. But those are the types of things that we have done at MicroConf. In terms of the question itself about where this anger comes from, my best guess is probably that it's rooted in history. Humanity has kind of thousands of years of history illustrating that people in positions of power are going to do whatever it takes to maintain that power. And quite frankly, if you look at the balance of power over the past few thousand years, white men have kind of largely been at the top of that power structure. And by extension, other white men have benefited from that arrangement. If you look at that historically, those people tend to be afraid of change. They're generally afraid of women or anyone who's different than they are from having those types of power or perceived power over them. And I think it's just a gender issue, but it is also to some extent a racial issue. But the bottom line of this is that Rob and I don't necessarily feel qualified to answer the first question which Samori posed to us, which is where does all this anger come from? Because one, it's not something that we really feel, but it's also not directed at us. So what I did was I went out and I decided to find somebody who I would see as an expert in this particular space. And I want to introduce you to Brianna Wu, who is the founder of Space Cat Games. Brianna, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. I'm doing fine. It's a pleasure to be on.
Excellent.
I do want to say my company's name is Giant Space Cat.
Oh,
not
I'm
Space
sorry.
Cat Games.
Yes. No, I apologize. I apologize.
Yeah. Can we go back to some of your answers to that previous question a little bit?
Sure.
So I am a software engineer. So something I think about a lot when I'm trying to solve problems is I ask myself if my underlying assumptions are correct. And, you know, I assume you kind of do the same thing there, right? So I kind of want to go back to what you were saying at the very beginning of this, where you said you didn't feel comfortable asking attendees about their race and gender because you didn't feel comfortable with it and you didn't think that was relevant. Is that an accurate assumption of how you feel?
I'll be honest, it's not something that we feel is necessarily important to us asking the question.
Right. To us.
Well,
yes.
let me rephrase that because I know how maybe that sounds. It's more of a question of like, do we need this information? And I guess in retrospect, like in even asking that question, maybe we do. I've never really considered that before, to be honest.
Yeah, one of my first jobs was in politics. And, you know, I used to use the term African-American when I was talking about racial issues until someone that was Black came up to me and said, you know what, Black people, we don't use that term so much. It's kind of one that's more about white comfort in discussing racial issues. And I very much prefer to be called Black. And that was a real eye-opening moment for me. So I want to kind of give you the other side of what it's like to attend a conference if you're a woman. So this is a conversation I have several times a week. Like a friend is thinking about going to X, Y, or Z comp, and you know, women in the tech industry have our own secret spaces to talk to each other. And the first thing we ask is, hey, I've just been invited to speak at X comp. Is this safe? Does anyone have good experiences with this? How many women are there? And then we've kind of had to form our own groups to give feedback about that because you are thinking like, oh my gosh, I could be uncomfortable about asking a question for a second. The woman on the other side of that is asking really difficult questions like, am I going to be sexually harassed if I'm at a bar with alcohol? You know, am I going to be treated fairly and equally? And it's just something I would really encourage, not just you, but anyone out there that is in a position of privilege to kind of push past that and realize, you know, it's not comfortable for me to be on your podcast today talking about this stuff, but it's absolutely necessary because women leave the software industry at a rate over 3 times of what men do. I would also say, use the term female coder repeatedly when you're discussing this. I would just be honest and say most women I know prefer to be called women. Female kind of sounds like Ferengi. It's just kind of, it's kind of a demeaning way to talk about women. So yeah, that would be my feedback about that.
Got it. Okay. No, that a lot of that makes sense. But so I guess going back to your question of me about why we don't ask that, I guess in some ways it seems like there's almost a boundary that I'm stepping over as the host of a conference where I'm asking, I guess, somewhat personal information about like, okay, well, you know, are you male or female? Or, you know, what's your racial makeup? So stuff like that. It seems like, you know, why would I need to know that? Like, how is that perceived from the other side?
Well, I would say this, you know, I'm an engineer. I can't fix a bug in software I write if I don't have error reports, right? So you've got to measure data to figure out where you're going wrong and fix it. So I think it's wholly relevant. I think if even internally, you're not putting together numbers about your number of women speakers. And by the way, when we talk about this stuff, far, far, far too often, people of color are left off this list. So, you know, for me, at you know, the things I do, I am very, very aware of how many people of color I hire, how many women I hire. And, you know, frankly, because we're such a company that is heavy with women working there, we have to go the other way and make sure we hire men enough. So that would just be my feedback about that. You know, you can't fix something if you don't measure it or, you know, even understand if you have a problem in the first place.
But I think that also goes to how you ask the questions as well. I mean, you can't just say drop a question in somebody's email box and say, hey, you know, are you male or female? And then I would at least say preface it by, you know, some meaningful information or at least a couple of sentences about why it is that you're asking that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Okay. So I guess what are your initial thoughts on Samori's question itself about where some of the misogyny itself comes from?
Well, I think it comes from a very predictable place. You know, I grew up, I was a child in the 80s and the 90s, right? So this was a time where you really were punished for being a nerd. You know, I remember liking Final Fantasy as a child and getting picked on mercilessly about that at school. So I think it's really true that a lot of geeks grew up and they kind of have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. They feel like the underdog. And, you know, I think especially with women, I think there is definitely a culture where a lot of software people maybe are kind of sensitive around women or sometimes have some animosity against us that maybe they don't understand. So what you're dealing with at its core is a culture filled with men who genuinely believe they are too smart to be sexist, but they have these really aggressive tendencies that they may not understand. It makes them uncomfortable. They're very, 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 very quick to reframe things to protect their privilege. I'll give you an example. Oculus, which is a company that makes some technology we are very interested in, virtual reality, you know, they had yet another terrible scandal that broke 2 days ago, where one of their software people has been alleged of soliciting underage girl for sex. Very serious crime. If you put this in context of their crisis of leadership, of A, not hiring women, B, having a founder that's literally spending tens of thousands of dollars funding hate speech, it's a really troubling pattern. I was discussing this on Twitter, and I was instantly besieged by someone that believes he's an ally to women in tech, but is instantly minimizing it, is excusing it, and is just like throwing every argument there to say this isn't a problem. That man believes that he is an ally, but on an unconscious level, he is derailing and minimizing a conversation about structural bias. And that is everywhere in our industry. So, the way you will be able to know if you're on the wrong track is if you're looking at this problem of women in tech or people of color in tech, and you're saying, well, I know what the problem is. It's those other guys. No, you need to be saying, I know what the problem is. That's me. I'm not just telling people to practice what I preach. Yet for me, as a white person, I realize that I have tremendous advantages in our field, even as a woman. So, I'm constantly asking myself, like, am I hiring enough people of color? Am I interviewing enough people of color? Am I networking with enough people of color? When journalists call me and say, I'm looking for references, am I passing off enough people of color to them? And it's that kind of constructive engagement that really makes you part of the solution instead of pointing fingers.
Now, going back to one of the things that you had said earlier, which was, a lot of people feel like they are too smart to be sexist, for example. And I've had conversations with people in kind of along that lines, like, oh, I have two daughters. I can't possibly be sexist. and of course, like, that's a you can almost find political memes around that too. I mean, it's not hard to look for that type of thing. Are there specific signs that somebody can look for? I think a lot of the listeners to this podcast are more of the truth-seeking variety. They're really looking for validation of their ideas and thoughts and beliefs, and mostly that deals with marketing, but I feel like that applies in this particular situation as well. How is it that you identify the things that would say, hey, you know what, you aren't too smart for this? What are other canaries in the coal mine, so to speak?
Yeah, so one of the things I said is, imagine if you had a friend that was going through a divorce. And that friend was talking, they're like, oh, it's just so hard. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to see my kids again. Or, I'm really upset about losing my partner. I'm not sure if I'll ever find love again. Imagine if while you're talking to a person, you turn the conversation to yourself and said, well, yeah, but how's that going to affect me? Are we going to be able to hang out and go see movies all the same? Like, it'd be really obnoxious, right? In the same way, very, very, very often, when women start talking about what it's like, what our lived experiences are, men are so quick to turn the conversation to themselves and talk about how this affects them. And I'm trying to think of a constructive way to say this, but I can't. It's just obnoxious. So a really good hint that you're on the wrong path is if you're saying, well, you just feel this way because there aren't enough women applying. Or, well, what if I'm trying to apply to a job and I don't get a fair shake? Well, if I don't get into this conference because they've got a quota system, this is all a good sign that you're more concerned about your privilege than the problem. So we all have work to do. And I really want to emphasize this. I think something feminism could do a lot better. And I think outrage culture has a lot to contribute to this. But we've built this culture where everyone is one mistake away from being a villain for life. And I don't think it's a very good way to go forward. You know, I myself, if I'm a halfway decent ally to people of color these days, it's because I've made so many mistakes along the way, and I've learned from them. You know, we need to have a culture where men can make these kind of mistakes and we can have an honest dialogue about it, and they're not branded as villains for life. I think that we're really missing a more constructive way to move forward on it.
I guess kind of going back a little bit where you had said that one of those telltale signs is kind of saying, how does this affect me? Or kind of interjecting your own thoughts on it. I mean, previously, you had came out with a couple of examples there of what those red flags look like. And I had said that I have friends who have said, you know, I have two daughters. I can't possibly be like this. But I mean, is that along those lines as well? I mean, is that perceived as sexist? Because I mean, really, I mean, I was trying to contribute to the conversation and say, look, this has been my experience. But is that overshadow what we were talking about? Or is that perceived in a good light or a negative light?
Well, I would take this in two parts. I would say, first, I want to check my own privilege and say I'm a non-parent. So I am not, you know, I've never raised children. But I would say this, when a guy starts talking about how, you know, he's raising daughters, a red flag that goes up for me right away is a lot of men bring sexist attitudes into their role as father. I think we see a lot of controlling things with that. We see like a real culture of violence sometimes and ownership over their daughters. So to me, I don't read that as good or bad either way. I've certainly met a lot of sexist fathers throughout my career. As far as your own fears about that.
Well, what I was referring to is really like the fact that I was bringing up as kind of like an addition to the conversation.
Don't stress it. Yeah.
No. Well, I think that it's important to figure out what are your motivations for bringing up a particular point, because I've been in situations and seen conversations go where somebody will bring up something and there is almost a sense of one-upmanship about, oh, well, let me tell you this story. And I can see that playing into this type of conversation and how people portray themselves to each other and how people talk to one another. That's what I was more getting at.
No, I think that's dead on. I want to step out and take a little bit of a meta view for a second. At my studio, Giant Space Cat, you know, for our last game, we had all women working on our team. And it's not a format that I'd have going forward, but it was how we shook out. I was really stunned by how different our culture was. It was hyper collaborative. So in other engineering environments where I've worked with a lot of men, there does tend to be that sense of one-upmanship of I'm right here. And I hope this is okay to say, but it just seems like it's boys with toys almost. At my studio where it was all women, it was hyper collaborative and it was awesome. And it was us validating each other and trying to get input and working on things together. It was just entirely different culture. So I do think that a little bit of that culture of one-upmanship, I don't think it's a particularly healthy trait of the software industry. And I think one of the reasons that teams with better gender balance tend to be more productive is I do believe when all genders are represented, it brings a kind of stability and a diversity of viewpoints to the table. And I think that's very valuable.
Yeah. And we've noticed at MicroConf, I mean, when we started out back in 2011, the conference has always been very collaborative. Everyone is really comfortable sharing, for example, revenue numbers and discussing specifics of how their business is doing. But one of the things that comes to mind is that most of these people, they'll come to MicroConf and then they leave and then they're working in their own world and they may have a team, they may not. There are usually only one or two people working on a particular product or project and then they go out, they do their thing and they come to MicroConf and they collaborate. But when they're out working on their products and then their business, they tend to be alone or they tend to be working with very, very small teams. And I wonder how those two things play together, because it seems odd that those types of people would go out and be as aggressive as they need to be to run their business and then come to a place like MicroConf where there is this community or into Founder Cafe. And then they're very collaborative. It seems like those two things are very much opposed to one another.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I would want to touch on for a second that kind of bias that when we start companies, we tend to seek out people around us that kind of mirror our values. And I think a really big bias of this in, you know, in the startup world is this is why such a tiny sliver of startups have women or people of color on the board, because it is a culture that really pushes women and people of color away in ways we're not willing to think about. And I would use my own experience at Giant Space Cat and say, I did this the other way, being a woman founder, that when I started my company, I looked for people unconsciously that looked like me. And we had way, way, way too many white women on my team. And I realized that that was my own bias. So, you know, we've got to get past this point where our own comfort is our highest priority, because it is right now. And it leads to use cases that are just terrible. I want to talk about VR right now. If you look at the VR marketplace right now for Oculus games or Vive games, most of these are made by teams of two or three people, always men. And there are so many sexist assumptions built into these games as you play it that make it really damage VR from being able to pick up with the mainstream. A lot of these games assume you're a certain height. Most of them don't contain female avatar options. All of them like assume that you're a man as you play it. It's just really, really insulting in ways that I think these teams haven't really thought about.
Is that a function of the fact that it's only two or three people developing it, and so they tend towards doing things that are comfortable for them and are, I'll say, easy access to them, and more a lack of resources as well? Because, I mean, if you're going to create 30, 40, 50 avatars, I would imagine that that's a lot more work than it is to create one or two. So is it a function of time and resources, or is it a combination of that and the fact that they just say, oh, well, I only have time for this, so I'm going to concentrate on getting something out the door?
So, yeah, this is what I would call an excuse. You and I both know the features that get into a product are the ones your team cares about. We all know this. At GSX, the way we do it is we list every single feature as a gold, silver, or bronze tier. Gold must be done. Silver can be done. Bronze is nice if we get around to it. The features that are on that top priority list make it into the game. So the answer to this is simple. The men making these products don't consider it a priority. And like by your everything you just said, it's not a priority. So, you know, a guy can certainly do this well. I've seen it done, but it's just not important to them. And that's reflected in the software we use.
Right. Yeah. It's more of a matter of paying attention to that kind of thing and making it a priority, as opposed to just saying, oh, well, this is on the feature list and one or two is good enough.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the subtle things that go on. What are some overt examples? And I don't think that this is something that is front and center for most men in the industry, but what are the more overt things that you've seen?
This is such a good question. Yeah, we have a real tendency in software development to network in a way that was created by men for men. I could not even count how many times I've been at a bar at night alone, been the only woman there with a bunch of men that are drinking alcohol. You know, this is something I think dudes don't even think about. You know, I have had so many friends in that situation that have been sexually harassed. In two examples, I've had friends who've been sexually assaulted. In one example, I had a pretty close friend of mine have her boss basically force himself onto her at night while everyone was drinking. And, you know, there was some really inappropriate contact that was made. This is something that is much more of a problem than men realize. So our setup here is built in a way that, you know, networking is very difficult for, say, women over 30 with children. You're not going to find many moms that are going to be out drinking at 11 o'clock at night at a bar to work on their career. But this is like where 99% of the stuff happens in the game industry. So there's overt things. A lot of men tend to treat women they run into in professional circles as someone to date. And I want to take a step back and say, I realize that feminism and women are sometimes, I think there's a little bit of a lack of empathy for what it must be like for a male geek when he's just lonely and looking for someone to, you know, be a partner, like he's looking for romance. And I realize there's a sense of, maybe sometimes it's a sense of spot for them. I have empathy for that, but it is so wildly inappropriate at the same time to treat a woman that's coming in to network with you professionally as a potential partner. It sends every single signal out there that you're not valued for your skills, for who you are. You're just a potential date. So I think we've really got to change the culture where women and people of color are treated as the professionals we are rather than just women.
I don't necessarily think that that's just a software industry thing, though. I mean, because there's that's definitely a problem. I mean, obviously, like sexual assault is an issue regardless of what industry it is. But I've also talked to female founders who have just said, yeah, I don't go to evening events or after conference activities because I don't want to put myself in a situation where people are drinking and going to get it out of control. And I just don't want to have to deal with that. And I guess it can effectively minimize, you know, their opportunities for networking just by virtue of them not being willing to put themselves in situations like that. Whether it happens or not, if they're uncomfortable attending those networking events, then it puts them at a disadvantage outright.
Yeah, no, that's dead on. And I would say, look at the outcomes, right? Like, I hear this a lot. It's not just software. Well, you know, my husband is in biotech. He is head of IP for a company that's listed on the NASDAQ that just had their IPO. There are plenty of women that work at his company. So why is it so many other industries, you know, their rate of women might be lower, but it's not as embarrassing as software is? Why is this? Well, it's the culture, stupid. So, you know, like, I think we need to own these problems rather than minimizing them.
So what sorts of things can be done to help change the landscape, so to speak? You know, how do we go through and start enacting some changes?
Well, I would say for me, I hire a lot of people. So something I make a lot of personal efforts to do in my career is to network with people of color, because I realize without effort on my part, I'm going to only be talking to white people, which is, you know, it's unconscious racism. So I would say to anyone out there, when you see a woman that seems smart and accomplished on Twitter, follow her. So you're getting that voice in your feed. Make a deliberate effort to go out there and network with people of color. So you're hearing that perspective and adding it to your own. I never hire for any position without thinking about who my candidates are and asking myself if they're diverse. Yeah, that's very much a constructive thing you can do. If you don't hire and you're just on a team, I think you've really got to check your own unconscious double standards. What is beyond frustrating to me as a woman engineer is it doesn't matter what I say or what I do or what I have a technical opinion on. It gets challenged and bullied and just really hyper questioned in a way that my male colleagues do not. I was at WWDC a few years ago, and I was talking about Apple's Metal APIs that were announced at a party. And I'm sitting there talking to a guy, and he's like, I was giving opinions on it. I write Unreal for a living, and this is literally my field of hyper expertise. And this man just starts talking over me and lecturing me and mansplaining things. And I had to take a step back and say, hey, you know, the article you're talking about right now, I wrote that. And he just blinked at me twice and kept going. You know, there's this culture of, it's just, it seems like it's just something in a dude's mind where if a woman questions someone, a guy on something, it gets just doubled down on, or there's this defensiveness that comes up. So I would get on my knees and beg anyone out there to really think through those unconscious double standards you might be holding women and people of color in your life to.
Could you talk a little bit more, because this is the second time you've used that phrase, you know, unconscious double standards, and I'd like to know what other ones are there that we might have?
Sure. I think you can look at the last election, right, and see very clearly there were double standards that Hillary was held to with her unethical behavior versus the dude. So, yeah, this is all the way. Like, it's with, you know, when you're applying for positions, I think women's experience is judged in a different way than a man's is. I think all too often female communication styles are discounted. A really good one is, I think that often women's voices, you know, some women have kind of a vocal fry or, you know, a higher higher-pitched voice, and I've seen the way that they're not taken seriously. So there are all these double standards in what women say and do in our careers, where we're really beaten up about it. There was a great cartoon that came out this year where it was talking about women leaders and the communication style we have to adopt. And, you know, for a man, he could say, I need this done by Tuesday. If a woman says that, she's going to be considered abrasive. So we have to adopt communication styles like, what do you think about having this done by Tuesday? You know? So it's all these things where we're constantly dancing around male ego, and it's absolutely exhausting.
Well, shouldn't the question in general be, what do you think about having this done by Tuesday? Because it's, you know, and I'm not saying that from a female perspective. I'm saying that like from a general project management standpoint, because just because you think that it should be done by Tuesday doesn't mean that the other person, especially if you're working with a bunch of contractors or even, you know, employees, it almost doesn't matter. But like, there's a lot of things that go on that are not necessarily in your vision at the time when you ask that. I mean, there's a difference between like, hey, this is a deadline, we really need to have it done. But, you know, there's ways of phrasing that stuff anyway that are much more collaborative in nature. Because I've worked with contractors who you tell them, hey, I really need this done by Tuesday, and they've got a holiday coming up and you don't know it. You know, for example, if you got people who are working overseas, I mean, you're not in that culture, so it's not on your calendar. It is on theirs. But you have to be at least aware of what's going on. And unless you ask the question, it's very easy to get into a situation where you say something and say, hey, this needs to be done by Tuesday, and you're completely neglecting all the other things that that person has going on.
I would say this with all respect, Mike, but I think the exchange we just had here is a really good example of what can make women sometimes a little frustrated in our careers. I completely agree with you. That's my management style. I work through consensus and collaboration, and I believe if someone's good enough to be in the door, that they've earned, you know, a little bit of leeway with that. So we do work that way. But I think it's so quick. We're so quick in our field to minimize any point that a woman is making about this. So I'm going to be really direct with you here. Women are held to very harsh double standards whenever we show leadership or try to draw boundaries. And the things that we talk about are negated or minimized or put aside. Ask any woman that is in a position of leadership out there, if she has to alter her communication style to not threaten men, and she will absolutely 100% tell you that she does. So I just think that's really important. These are the realities that we face.
Yeah, I totally agree. I definitely think there is that double standard there, if, you know, depending on how a woman would phrase that. What are the types of things that communities and community leaders can do to help enact some changes here? I mean, we've talked about a little bit about the stuff on, I'll say, on more of an individual level, but what can communities like, you know, MicroConf and Founder Cafe and, you know, Startups, the rest of us do to help with these types of situations?
Well, I always make sure you're having enough women come in the door, network with women. Organizationally, you need to create a culture where women are not afraid to speak up. And by the way, this is a trait for any good leader. You know, in software development, it's just a reality. We have a lot of introvert engineers. I've worked with more than a few engineers who are on the autism spectrum. And, you know, to me, good leadership is creating an environment where everyone gets a say, not just the loudest voices in the room. So I think being very active about having a culture where maybe those people that speak a little too much, and I'm in that group, would kind of be checked a little bit. And, you know, you ask for consensus from other people. That's incredibly important. I would also say when issues come up, those need to be taken very, very seriously. Every woman I know is terrified of HR, because HR, very generally speaking, exists to protect the company, not protect the woman. In my entire career, I only know one or two women that have had sexual harassment incidents have had a good outcome by HR. You know, there are standards about that out there for that. Make sure you're holding yourself to that. I would also say, really think through your interviewing process. In the game industry, I can't tell you how many times I've heard a story about a woman going to interview for a job and it uses male pronouns, it assumes certain things, or she's, you know, interviewed in a room with like posters on the wall of like half naked women. You've really got to think about your culture and ask yourself what kind of messages you're sending.
What would be better ways to, for example, you said job listing or job interviews, like what would be better ways of referring to that in like in a job post, for example? I mean, do you say he/she? Would you say he or she? Or would you try and avoid gender in any way, shape or form?
I personally try to talk around, you know, gender issues. I'd be honest and say I, like a lot of other people, am still kind of trying to figure out how to speak in a way that doesn't exclude non-binary people. It's kind of something that only first came up, you know, 2 years ago, really, in the mainstream. So I myself try to just kind of leave gender out of it whenever I can. That's a personal style thing, and I fail at it sometimes.
So going back to the communities, like, do you have any other recommendations or thoughts on networking events that could be a little bit more collaborative in nature? Because as I said before, one of the issues that I've seen is that female founders tend to shy away from going to evening events, or especially ones where there's alcohol involved in any way, shape, or form. And I have talked to people who, you know, have said, you know, I have been sexually harassed at such and such conference. Is MicroConf safe for me to come to?
I guarantee you women are having that conversation back channel a lot more than to your face.
So, like, what sorts of things would you recommend, or, you know, could we look at?
Well, I would say this. I really doubt that my company will ever have events with alcohol at it. And I realize that there's some people in our field that kind of need alcohol to feel comfortable. But yeah, from my perspective, I'm always thinking about my safety first and foremost. And I just, you know, can't allow something that would compromise that. I think, just to really be honest with you here, I think the threat of sexual assault is something men don't ever have to think about and women think about all the time. So I personally don't do that. I'm also increasingly skeptical about the value of face-to-face networking. I think it definitely has its place. I do most of my networking on Twitter and in private groups on Facebook. So I'm always looking for those kind of personal relationships. I think lunch networking events and coffee are hyper productive. So I'm always looking for those kinds of places that are just a little bit more congenial.
One of the other things I wanted to touch on was that I recently read that you're running for Congress. What prompted that?
Just to be really open, you know, I try to steer away from politics as much as I can in my technical career. But honestly, on election night, I was 30 feet from where Hillary Clinton should have accepted the presidency, and she didn't. And like a lot of other marginalized people, I'm really scared about my rights under Trump administration. So, you know, something I've been thinking about for a long time. There's really this meta question of how can we go further than we are right now. And I personally believe that we've reached a real asymptote with what writing about sexism and talking about sexism is going to accomplish in our field. The truth is, I could come on 1,000 podcasts this year like this one and talk about the same thing. I'm not sure it's going to get us much further than where we are right now. So I think the next step is to have women involved in the legislature. You know, the guy I'm going to be running against has spent his entire career crusading against women's rights. He's pretty terrible on technology issues. And, you know, even stepping beyond being a woman in tech, I think there's a much, much larger issue here. You know, our federal tech policy sucks. And it's dumb.
I think that's an understatement by any stretch of the imagination.
It really is. I have to say this. You know, one of the women I'm hoping to serve on a technology subcommittee in the House when I run, you know, when the Mirai botnet came out a few months ago and completely took out parts of the internet in the United States, this woman went on CNN and blamed a botnet, which is, you know, it happened because we don't secure Internet of Things devices and allow them to be rewritten in a way that can attack our technology infrastructure. And she blamed a freaking SOPA, like, you know, pirating movies and software. And it's just like, it's a policy position that was literally written by Verizon, you know? I am angry about that. And our poor technology policy is not just stupid, it's endangering our national security. security. So a lot of the reason I'm running is I want to be a voice in the Congress on privacy rights, on the EFF, on all of these policy issues where, you know, with all respect to, you know, the politicians of the baby boomer generation, I absolutely respect your service. But I think that someone that is kind of native to this technology, I simply understand it better than most people do. And we need people in Congress fighting for privacy rights, you know, people holding companies accountable when their data is breached in horrific ways and endanger all of the people that've had their information stolen. You know, it's a very wide array of issues while I'm running. It's not just gender equality. To be honest, it's that SOPA thing really made me mad. I think there's a certain point where every generation needs to step up and commit ourselves to public service. And again, there are a lot more baby boomers in the Congress than there are Gen Xers. And I just think it's time for us to serve.
Well, again, Brianna, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show. So this is episode 322. And if you have any comments or thoughts on the show, head over to the website, startupsforrestofus.com, and you can leave some comments on the website and talk a little bit more about this episode. If you have a question for us, you can call our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsforrestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.